The Hatchcast is sponsored in part by Spartan Innovations. Spartan Innovations provides startups spinning out of MSU's ecosystem the commercialization support and financial resources necessary to turn MSU research technologies into successful Michigan businesses.
This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by the MSU Entrepreneurship Association. The MSUEA is a registered student organization open to all majors who are passionate about entrepreneurship. Find out more at msuea.org.
This episode of the Hatchcast is brought to you by Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. The Burgess Institute empowers students to learn through action by providing programs, courses, and resources to foster an entrepreneurial mindset and create new ventures. One name, one program, limitless you. Learn more at eship.msu.edu.
Welcome to
Creativity,
Risk-Taking,
Entrepreneurship,
Community,
Innovation,
Ambition.
This is
the Hatchcast.
I should ask, sorry, that was a short break. Does anybody recognize or use any of the resources on that sheet in front of you? And don't worry if it's crickets in here and everybody says no, that's the point of us being here. So we want to make sure that people have an idea of what's available so you can get access to this information a little bit more often. All right, so on the next slide right here, we're looking at a quadrant of what are the leaders in customer relationship management models. So at the very top on the right-hand side, we have Oracle, Adobe, Salesforce. We've probably heard of them a little bit. But what are some of those companies that are going to be at the bottom left-hand side where we haven't really heard them too much? They are niche players. So going back to that previous slide where some of the companies we may not have heard of them, they might be small startups in a different part of the country or so, they're going to pop up in the bottom left-hand corner. This is just to identify who are the players in the game that we want to join in the future.
All right, so we're on to the last one, which is cost. And what I think is important to say here is that we should really all value the skills, time, and effort required to produce knowledge. Authority is really contextual, so there's an authority on cost. An example that comes to mind for me is gas. Most of us don't know, who regulates gas. It's the DOJ, the CFTC, the EIA, there's a ton of different regulatory bodies that have to go through that information before you ever get to the pump to pump your gas. Similarly, in marketing, the FTC looks at regulations constantly. So authority is really contextual, and I've got a couple more examples. So at scale, Cristiano Ronaldo is a top influencer. I don't think anyone's going to deny that. His name's out there everywhere. And according to Influencer Marketing Hub, he actually is the top. But of course, it depends on the context. So one influencer who I follow, big climber, is Jimmy Chin. Anybody know the name Jimmy Chin? I see a couple head nods, pretty much. Oh, a couple yeses. So you kind of get where I'm going. Context really, really is important. So depending on the room, Jimmy Chin would have more influence than Cristiano Ronaldo. So most of us know this intrinsically, that authority is contextual, but many of us just forget this in the research process. And I will say that that's really, part and parcel to what we do here at Michigan State. We try and simplify that process for you. I will also say as a further point, be mindful of free. I'm just going to kind of let that sit for a second. So the time and effort required to produce knowledge, to learn a skill, it's not without cost, right? So the last two slides kind of broke down. If anybody was paying attention on the previous slide, what do sort of influencers pull in as far as some of that income? And it's pretty sturdy. And that really brings us to our last slide. We really didn't want to take up too much time tonight. So I wanted to let you read this quote. If your aspirations are not greater than your resources, you're not an entrepreneur. So my contention is really that you should marshal both. As students here at Michigan State University, you have access to so many resources. You know, we took a poll and most of you have never seen these resources. You probably didn't know that we spend six figures on all these resources and more. We've got 100 different business databases. We've got 1,000 different databases. So really take advantage of your resources. You're here tonight, so you're taking advantage of one resource that's here on campus. But I can't stress the importance of these resources. And again, we've got a little thing for you here at the end as well.
So as information professionals, we could talk your head off for hours about all the resources we have around here at Michigan State University. They are complimentary while you are part of the community here. But the bigger part of this lesson is to get an idea of how to use them. So when you get out into the world and you start a company or you join a company and you have access to maybe a quarter of our collection, you have an idea of how to use it. You know how to navigate the customer pool or to use people as your resources or to figure out, okay, what industry or market am I going into? What's my competition? So you're always going to be doing research. We just want to make sure people have an idea of what we can lend to you right now. If you do have questions further on, a lot of people don't know what they want to ask when they are posed with the question of what do you want to ask? Feel free to reach out to us. Our contact information is at the bottom of each form. But we also have jump drives for anybody who wants a little bit more information and reports like the ones that we showed on the slides. We want to make sure that you are handed with as much information as possible that we have here, and you can just run from there with that, or you can contact us if you want more.
Yeah, and I would just say, so they're just 1 gig drives. For those of you who have a new Mac, maybe you don't have a port for it, but if you do want this, we've got 10 reports on here from PwC, KPMG, CB Insights. So just 2020 trends that perhaps you'd find interesting on consumers and kind of the way of the world, fintech, that sort of thing. So just something we thought might be interesting. Thanks.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys. Thank you. You bet. Thank you, guys.
Can you all join me giving William and Ben another round of applause, please?
Thank you very much.
So I didn't get a chance earlier to kind of give him a proper introduction, but I'm glad at the end there, Ben kind of hit home on the magnitude of the resources. So I don't know about you, but now when I was growing up, the library was kind of a static place that we went to, right? And there wasn't a lot in the way of resources beyond some of the staff that were there. And so it's important for you to recognize that literally I was saying thousands, Paul was like tens of thousands, and then you all confirmed hundreds of thousands and the six figures in terms of resources that you have access to for free as an enrolled student, if you are a student, because I know we have friends and family here and the public that are here because our esteemed speaker draws a pretty massive and awesome crowd. But if you're an enrolled student at Michigan State, you get access to this stuff for free. And so I imagine Jeff was sitting back here thinking about the content that we're talking about and wishing, oh my gosh, he wishes some of this stuff were here. He knew about it at least when he was a student at Michigan State. So if you're thinking about starting a venture or you don't know where to begin, you have to do research. You have to figure out who your customers might be. What's the value of the market that you're looking to disrupt or that you're looking to enter? The library, and not just the staff, but the resources they can provide you access to are incredible. So do not miss out on that opportunity. So make sure and utilize the resources they're talking about. And they're going to be here back for several of our other Innovate States this spring. And they're also going to provide, again, content that's relevant to the speaker that night. So it's going to be a really neat way for you to learn about, based on the industry you're looking to enter into, how you might be able to utilize some of the resources here. So thanks again, gentlemen. Really appreciate their time. I want to talk about a few upcoming events we have here at Michigan State. Again, my name is Chris Sell. I lead alumni engagement for the Burgess Institute. How many of you, this is your first Innovate State at Michigan State? First timers? All right. I like it. How many of you are MSU students? Awesome. How many of you are not a student at Michigan State? Raise it high and proud. Like it. Awesome. Welcome. Ruben, glad you could be here. Thank you for being here. And thanks for the friends and family of Jeff that made it here. I know he appreciates your attendance as well. I just want to give a couple upcoming announcements about programs that are happening in the future that if you are a student or perhaps you're a community member and you want to be involved, there's an opportunity for you as well. So Innovate State is one of many different activities we offer here on Michigan State's campus. In addition to Innovate State, we've got things like East Lansing Startup Weekend. Who's done Startup Weekend before? Brian, I know you have. Don't forget about that. Excellent. Glad to see a lot of hands raised. Startup Weekend is a national or potentially global program that's put on by Techstars. And the Burgess Institute is pleased to host the Startup Weekend program for the East Lansing and Lansing community. It's open not just to students, but to really anyone in the community or in the public that wants to bring a concept or an idea Startup Weekend, and then potentially you get to form a team, kind of coalesce around that idea, and maybe start a venture within 54 hours. So you'll come here Friday evening. We feed you handsomely throughout the weekend, tons of great food, all local businesses, of course. And then on Sunday, the top teams get to pitch that idea to a panel of judges. And it's an amazing, exciting, super fun weekend. Everyone that's done it, if you raised your hand, again, raise your hand again if you've done Startup Weekend. Raise it so that everyone else in the room can see it. Awesome. If you want to learn more about it and maybe participate, find one of the folks that raised their hands or talk to Paul or myself, and we can talk to you more about how to do it. We provide a discounted fee for a student to participate, correct? Awesome. Is that 50% off? A lot of percent off. How much does it cost? Tell me. $25. And that includes all your meals. Beautiful. So you get that and then some just in meals, y'all. Like in the first meal, you get that. It's amazing. So for sure, if you're thinking about it, apply now. It's happening February 7th through the 9th. Yeah. Okay, good. Y'all are nodding your head. I got the dates right. Perfect. So that's one of our upcoming events. Not to be mistaken or outdone, we also have a university-wide business model competition for our students at Michigan State. No matter your major, your minor, you or your status as a student, if you're a graduate, undergraduate, you are encouraged to participate in the Burgess New Venture Challenge. We are live right now accepting applications for that until mid-February. And we are looking for students that have some type of business model concept that they want to pitch. And so we are taking applications now again through mid-February. And if you're thinking about that, have more questions about it, Paul and Lori are people to talk to you to learn more about the Burgess New Venture Competition. If I'm not mistaken, we hand out $55,000 in prize money-ish. Sure, around that amount. And the final showcase for that is Tuesday, March 24th at the Wharton Center. And at that point, we'll have approximately the top 15 student finalist teams actually pitch to a panel of judges that day and then participate in the student final showcase that afternoon and evening at the Wharton Center. So it is the premier student business model competition here at MSU. So make sure and get your application in if you haven't already. Just as a reminder, if you want to follow on along a line for tonight's conversation, you can use the hashtag InnovateState. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can follow along the conversation there. And tonight's conversation is going to be recorded in a Hatchcast. I know Jeff, our speaker, interviewed with our team earlier today, but all of our Innovate States are actually produced as a podcast, and so which is called Hatchcast. And you can find us on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, all the places you get your regular podcast. So find us there as well. It's a great way to kind of revisit some of the content that you're learning about tonight. Lastly, our next Innovate State is 2 weeks from today, February 5th. And that's going to be all about brands. It's a special edition. The first time we've ever brought three people back at the same time to talk about a particular concept or idea. So we've got folks flying in from New York City, Boston, and coming in from Southeast Michigan. They're all experts in the space of brands, but coming at it from a different angle, whether it's fashion, lifestyle, luxury brands, whether it's food brands, or perhaps it's music and how do we create music for brands. It's super cool. It's going to be really exciting. And we're doing that in a few weeks on February 5th. So please put on your calendars, be here. I think that's about it. Just in terms of kind of housekeeping protocol for tonight, I don't even really see any laptops, which is amazing, which means that the precedent has been set. I want you to give your full attention to tonight's speaker. He flew in all the way from New York City to give you your time. And take copious notes. And again, we're going to store this as a video so we can send it after the fact. You can find it on the web. It's going to be a fireside chat format, but you all are going to get an opportunity to ask questions of Jeff after some of the questions are asked this evening. Sound good? Awesome. Without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce our moderator for tonight, my colleague, Paul Jakes. Paul is the co-director of the Burgess Institute for Entrepreneurship and Innovation at Michigan State. In this role, Paul works with students at MSU to take their ideas from the very beginning stages to the market. He runs MSU's student incubator, the MSU Hatch, and is the creator of the Conquer Accelerator program that some of you might be familiar with that takes place each summer here in East Lansing. In addition to his leadership role, Paul is the CEO of a recruiting firm, We Connect Talent. He's the COO of SPC Innovations, which created Brick Shield, which if you're near Lagos, is a semi-permanent adhesive for plastic brick toys, aka Legos, amongst other things. He's a member of the Altruist Investment Fund and recently even authored a children's book. And if you don't have a copy, I've got one on my desk in my office. So come find it or snag it on Amazon, if I'm not mistaken. He's blushing, but you can find it there. Paul, you want to come up here? Can you all join me in welcoming Paul to the stage?
You're most welcome.
And then I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Jeffrey Epstein is an accomplished attorney, entrepreneur, and investor. He grew up in Southeast Michigan and headed to the mid-Michigan area to attend MSU, where in 2004, he received his bachelor's degree from the Eli Broad College of Business. From MSU, he went on to earn his Juris Doctorate from the Chicago Kent College of Law in 2007. Jeff sold his first online business in 2007, a success allowing him to pay back his student loans in full. Oh, man, that's amazing. I'll get there someday. And blazing the path for his next venture, Ambassador Software, which at the time of its creation in 2010 became a leading referral marketing platform used by some of the world's most recognizable brands. So again, influencer marketing, Jeff, there's a connection there. He can talk more about that here this evening. Jeff and his team grew Ambassador Software to 45 full-time employees. And in late 2018, the company was acquired by West Corporation. That's a big deal. As a passionate entrepreneur, he's attended and participated in Techstars, New York City, 2011, raising several million dollars along the way in VC funding. Although he has made mistakes in his time, his words, not mine, Jeff now focuses on capitalizing and learning from them by consulting, investing, and helping other entrepreneurs learn and grow from the mistakes and troubles he has experienced throughout his career. I know you all are going to learn a ton from tonight's speaker. Jeff's going to drop some serious knowledge. Paul's got some great questions lined up. If you can all join me in welcoming Jeff Epstein up here to the front.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thanks, sir. That's great.
Can you hear us all right? You guys can you hear us?
Hello?
I don't have a mic working.
Hello?
I think we're out. Okay. Here, you can talk about that. All right. So we're going to get you in the hot seat.
Sweet.
Right away. So we talked about you from Michigan. Where from Michigan are you from?
Grew up in West Bloomfield.
West Bloomfield. And then you went to State. Why'd you pick Michigan State?
Both my parents went to State, lifelong Spartan fan, and I thought it was like the best place for me, to be honest. I only applied to a couple schools, and I wanted to come to MSU, and so I visited when I was in high school, and I loved it, so
great.
That was awesome.
Glad you picked Michigan State, for sure. So talk about that. You come to State, and you want to pick a major. Did you know what you wanted to do right at the beginning, or how did that go?
So actually, I was in James Madison. So I started in James Madison because apparently I was good at arguing or debating with people, and that would be a good place for me, I guess my parents said. But I was always into business and eventually decided to try to do a dual degree. So I was on the five-year plan and ended up graduating from the School of Business in 2004 and then went to law school right after. So I didn't actually graduate from Madison, but I did all the classes, but my language. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
And then went on to get your JD.
Yeah.
Were you thinking that when you were in your undergrad, or were you, what did you think about that?
Yeah, pretty, you know, I think looking back on it, I think I tried to defer like getting a real job for as long as possible, which is not a good strategy. It's like, hey, let's keep going to school. Right. And then thinking about loans and all those things, you kind of realize, man, it's kind of expensive to keep going if you don't know what you want to do. But, for me, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I didn't know, you know, what I was going to do and kind of in the world when I grew up, so to speak. So I went directly to law school right after, MSU and you know, at the time I was fortunate enough to be able to pay off my loans, but I was pretty terrified graduating law school, not wanting to be an attorney and not really knowing what I was going to do with my life. So it's interesting.
So talk about that. They said that in your bio, you had a company that you started and you paid off your school with that. Talk about the company you started and how that worked out.
Yeah. So the company I started it's called affiliate marketing. It's very similar to what's now like influencer marketing, but it was really helping people, you know, getting connected to businesses and services. And in my case, it was in the mid 2000s. It was online poker, which was very popular back in the day. And so that was sort of my passion when I was here at MSU. I met a lot of friends playing poker and playing online poker. And so I started this company where we could basically refer people to various poker sites. And then we would basically make money off that, just like an influencer does for referring clothes or hats or, you know, shoes, what have you. And so we did that, and it was pretty successful. And again, was fortunate enough to kind of get out of it as poker was becoming sort of quasi illegal. And then wasn't, you know, able to pay off my loans, which was huge at the time, because it was kind of, you know, it was kind of a scary burden that was kind of hanging over me. So
I'd like to know more about that, because we work with students every day that, I mean, a lot of the companies that I've been in and the mistakes that I've had is a lot of times I didn't know what I was doing, or I made a ton of mistakes. Did you know what you were doing when you were launching this influencer thing about poker? You knew about poker.
Yeah.
But how did you know how to start up a company, an entity, reach out to people, things like that?
So that specific business was a lot of luck. In my opinion, because it wasn't really it was a company.
Timing too?
Yeah, for sure timing, right? It was really just taking a hobby of mine and finding kind of a hole in the universe, so to speak. People were making money referring poker players, and I happened to know dozens of poker players because on MSU on MSU campus there were a ton, and our friends of friends, and so we made connections just through my own network. So it was more timing and circumstance than kind of strategically figuring out how to build a company. I almost kind of lucked into that, I guess you could say. I would say, like, if you've ever influenced people, like your friends or relatives, it's sort of like that, but just multiplied by all the people all the people you know in a small community. So in that case, it was, I think, a lot more luck than what later was Ambassador was. Again, building both a product and then an actual company. The challenge was, though, you know, making those mistakes along the way and really learning from them, because, you know, many times the business maybe should have either gone under or lost a lot of money. And I was fortunate, again, living in Southeast Michigan, it wasn't too expensive to sort of just live. And I lived in my parents' basement for a while. To save money and sort of survive, even though the product wasn't making any money and I wasn't making any money. In fact, we were spending money to get people to develop it for us.
So it sounds like it was kind of non-traditional. You didn't really have to raise a lot of money. It sounded like you had the connections, so it was pretty easy for you to do. I think, and I say that because a lot of the students that come to us look at the traditional venture capital angel and they're like, I got to raise all this money and get this investment. Didn't sound like it was that way.
No, and realistically... And people ask me this all the time, you know, ask about fundraising or say they need to fundraise. And it's tends to be something, if you're interested in startups, one of the first things you want to talk about is how do you raise money? And the reality is, for most of the times, the money raises itself. And what I mean by that is your business is in a position where someone smart who has money wants to put it in there. It's very rare that you convince people to give you money, that you're like sort of outsmarting them, right? Like investors... are investors for a reason. Typically, they've done quite well. They've made a lot of money. They see patterns in terms of products that have traction that can create, essentially, that can grow into bigger products and bigger companies. So the more you focus on just building something that that makes sense or that solves a problem, the easier it'll be to raise money instead of raising money to then do the thing, right? That's a lots of people try to do that. It's network or no network. I didn't have a network at the time. I got lucky and someone gave me $25,000 as an investment, but we already had $50,000 in revenue. So we were already making more than the investment in, from a revenue perspective, even in the early days.
So you brought up Ambassador.
Yeah.
When did you start that and how did that happen?
So I started Ambassador in 2010.
And that, so there was a, you sold when? 2000, your first company.
2007 was when I graduated law school.
So there was a lull in between there?
Yeah. So 2007, graduated law school in Chicago, move home late 2007. Take the bar, played a little bit of poker, played a little bit of poker in there. And then actually in between, which I don't talk about that much, it's not super relevant, but I actually decided that since I watched a lot of HGTV, I was going to flip a house and figure out how to do that. So it's, you know, I ended up basically with some of the money left over, I had a down payment to buy a house to live in.
Market was good to buy.
The economy was awful. It was all foreclosures, unfortunately. The market was horrible to get a job. My wife and I got a house in Royal Oak and we decided we'd fix it up. And once we sold that house, we then had nowhere to live. And that was when we moved into my parents' basement, essentially. So that was going on while I was trying to build, you know, this internet company, so to speak. And I had no, you know, the resources that you guys have here, it's really like amazing. I was telling Aaron earlier, I didn't know anyone who could like develop a website. Like I didn't even know that like people existed, that wasn't common. Startups weren't like cool or known. So for me, I paid a company in Poland to do it. And so I was like doing a little bit of work, but they were doing a lot of the work in Poland. And just, you know, we were communicating every couple of days. So for me, there wasn't this community that I could, you know, connect to or even people that I knew that were interested in doing this stuff with me. So it was pretty lonely. I was doing it by myself while I was like fixing up this house, hoping that one day I'd have this sort of online company, online business. And as I got into like 2010, that was when it was, you know, I decided it's going to focus on it more full time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was what, you know, became of Ambassador.
Let's go back a little bit.
Sure.
Because you did bring up a good point. They do get tons of resources. When you were here in school and you were working on that first idea, what did you have? I mean, was there anything? I mean, did you talk to, was there outside mentors? Was there professors? Was there...
For me, I didn't utilize any of those. I'm sure like there are some resources available, but nothing close to what is here. I mean, it's a kind of amazing and I'm super jealous of what you guys have now. But there was certainly no space, no, I don't even know if there's like an entrepreneurship club or anything. You know, I mean, it wasn't a minor, certainly. I was again telling Aaron earlier, my freshman year was the first year they actually had high speed internet in the dorm. So, I mean, I'm dating myself a bit, but I mean, it was really cool that we could actually just like go online and it wasn't dial tone.
Right.
So that was pretty rare. Most of you guys don't even get that, which kind of sucks. So, it was really bad.
Get off the phone.
Like imagine when your phone's like breaking up, like when it's horrible connection, that's like 1,000 times faster than what it was for us.
This big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
okay, so that was the point I was getting to, the resources that you had, and you're right, there was nothing. The ecosystem, the area, there was really nothing. Well, of course, there was entrepreneurs. There's always been entrepreneurs in the area, but and it's built over those years. So, Ambassador, you always had this idea, or you did something click, or how'd you get into it?
So the idea really stemmed from the poker company that I had, and. With the way that we acquired more poker players, again, I knew I had a network of friends that played poker. But what we did was we went on AOL Instant Messenger. Again, that was the social network of the day.
Who knows what that is?
Yeah, do you guys, anyone? Okay. All right, cool.
Anybody have the discs still?
Yeah. So that was the way that people communicated. It was the chat, the only chat that sort of existed, right?
Yeah.
And we would chat our friends from high school or other colleges and say, hey, sign up. Did you play poker? Yeah, of course. Use this. Just like, again, just like an influencer would do today for a product or service. And so that was the idea. It was like, wow, I can't believe that it became friends of friends, became tens of thousands of people generating millions of dollars for these poker sites. So that was a complete eye opener. Because again, this, you know, social networks didn't even exist back then, right? And so when Facebook came online and Twitter, all of a sudden I said, wow, businesses can like leverage this across, you know, across people, right? Everyone has a voice now. It's not just, you know, me talking to my friends on AOL. It's now I can blast something to the world and whoever, you know, sees my hashtag can see it. And so that was the genesis of Ambassador was, hey, anyone can be a publisher, so to speak. Anyone can publish this. Businesses can harness that power to get more customers for themselves.
I'm curious how you went about it because they didn't have the resources then.
Right.
I mean, there was no business model canvas. There was no, how did you outline or draw, or was there a napkin sketch, or was there something like that that you thought, I mean, you had AOL and you could look at that, but how'd that work?
I literally did everything wrong. So that's like the answer. It's like, I wasted just a ton of time and energy being so naive that I just tried to do things. And then when I realized that they were bad or wrong, like eventually we changed them. And so again, like there's the business model canvas, there's like the startup, like the lean startup methodology, the things that make so much sense. Yeah. And it just helps you get from like zero to, you know, one
just in exploring.
Right. And, and thinking through a business model, like those things, I don't even know if I knew what a business model was more than like a big, you know, typed out 20 pages. Right. And which I definitely didn't do. So, for me, it was getting lucky, but also making mistakes and surviving the mistakes. And again, I lived with my parents. Like I had very little needs. I was young and like didn't have really a family, or I don't even think I had a dog, or just got a dog maybe, but I had no bills. So I was able to make mistakes, and the cost was, I wasn't making a lot of money, but I could survive. And that was kind of how you learn and continue to get, you know, to push forward ultimately.
So you start this company. When do you see it flourish, grow, and then you got outside investment?
Yeah.
Did you need that right away, or would you push on?
It's looking back, it's hard to tell. I mean, it's interesting to think about like when we needed investment. And there's certain stages of a life cycle of a business where it makes sense to invest ahead of where you are. And I would say for several years, which now I would say most good companies can get this down to months or a year. It probably took me two or three years to get to a place where it made sense to take money, because we were doing so many things wrong that the money would have been wasted too quickly. Yeah. Right. And then once you do that, your business is in real trouble because no one's going to want to give you more money. So we were fortunate that for a period of almost 2 or 3 years, we just kind of incrementally grew, like slowly by slowly. And it was a subscription software business, which means, you know, the money keeps coming in. So, you know, every month, like a little more would stack on top of it. So what became $100 a month was $200 a month was $2,000 a month. So that, you know, snowballed, right? Like sort of compound interest.
You're seeing people want this.
Right. And so,
and you're running this out of your mom's basement right now? Yeah.
So two years later, let's say it was post Techstars, right? So the validation took place.
Let's back up there. Okay. I don't think everybody know what Techstars is? A lot of them don't know what that means.
Okay. Techstars. Yeah. So Techstars is an incubator or accelerator, really, where you apply with a business, with a team, and basically there's sort of a overarching team that sort of picks the 10 best. In our case, it was the 10 best companies. We all got flown to New York, or most of them were in New York. And then for a period of like 4 months, we were just immersed full time with, you know, meetings with mentors, investors, other entrepreneurs, and they basically just kind of, for lack of a better term, beat the shit out of me with feedback and anything you can think of in terms of trying to, you know, really battle test both you as an entrepreneur and your idea and your team.
And you were very early in the Techstars program.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it was,
I don't know when they exactly started, but
yeah, it was like their third or fourth year. I mean, now Techstars is everywhere. They own Startup Weekend, if you know that. So they're quite a big organization today, but back then it was, maybe, you know, there were maybe six classes of Techstars. Now maybe there may be like 30 or 40 now.
So they infuse you with a little bit of money, put you through the program, and their big push then was the mentors and the overarching.
Correct.
Still is.
Yeah.
A little more money.
Yeah. Yeah. So the money that we got $18,000 for three people to live in New York for 4 months. So we basically lost money on that trade.
Yeah.
And 6% of the company. So like that's, you know, so we didn't make, you know, yeah.
You don't have to share that.
No, that's great. No, it's public now. Yeah. But no, but that was like, I mean, they advertise. I mean, it's pretty, that's kind of, at least at the time, that was pretty consistent with what they did.
And what are they now?
I don't know, but I mean, I think they do around that percentage, but they give like, I think $100,000 now, right? Okay. So yeah, we got $18,000, which, you know, for three people, I think my rent in a really crappy, dirty apartment was like more than, I mean, I got six of the 18 and my apartment was like $10,000 rent. So yeah, it's crazy.
So going back to that, you had Techstars. Is that something you would push people towards? Because
for sure.
Techstars, if you know it or not, they don't take many companies in Michigan
that I know of.
It's a lot of West Coast, East Coast companies. So it's a lot of people who are in the entrepreneur area aspire to be. So it had to be huge. You guys had to be excited.
Yeah. For me personally, it was like super validating. And at that point, like I literally got accepted like 3 months after I got married. So it was a big commitment to leave Michigan. Now that I actually was about to get a house after moving out of my parents' basement, I was then moving to New York. So it was a pretty validating for sure. And it was not easy. I think 1,000 companies applied and 10 got in. It was really, really fortunate and I think lucky to get in. But it's one of those things where, you know, for me, my thought process was it was something that I couldn't pass up.
Yeah.
And the amount of personal and like professional growth that you get in that is kind of unmatched. You know, I mean, you know, no offense to any, you know, educational institutions, but like, I mean, 4 months of like dedicated, like on like, you know, battle tested, feedback and mentorship. It was something that it's almost impossible to get anywhere else.
So did you, when you left the program out of New York, you came back home?
Yep.
Did you right away just blow up?
No.
Okay.
Came back home. And something that probably a lot of people will go through if they partner with people and build companies, actually had the people that I went to Techstars with, actually we dissolved. They no longer were with the company a few months after Techstars.
How does that work? Talk about that. Cause we have a lot of team dynamics. And one of the things I always say is there was three of you.
Yes, but I hired them right before. So we weren't like equal co-founders or anything. They did. Yes,
okay,
they did. Yeah.
A lot of times we have these student teams that have, I don't know, the suite number three or four.
Yeah.
Now we say it's kind of like roommates. One of you is going to hate each other. Or one of you is going to drink somebody's milk or somebody's going to do something. And I say that right off the bat. And 9 times out of 10, back me up, lowering others, it happens almost every time. And then they come to us and say, this person's not doing as much. Right. This person wants out. How's that work?
Yeah. So the best thing you can do is really prepare, and it's not a fun conversation to have, but, and this is where my legal background, one of the few, a few times it actually paid off. But if you do start a company with, you know, multiple people, you should have what's called like a vesting schedule. And so at the very least, everyone earns sort of their equity over time. And if there's a disagreement, if there's a, you know, if people want to part ways for whatever reason, if someone wants to leave the business, there's sort of an equitable way to divide up what you've earned. And then even you can even go further and have like what we had was a cliff. So if you didn't last sort of the first year, then you got nothing. So one of the people actually didn't even make a year. The other one was a little bit over a year. So when ended up getting equity and actually did really well when we sold, which was kind of crazy, 7 years later. But that's sort of planning ahead. And had I not done that, it would have been very costly and really burdensome to have that much equity owned by people that are doing none of the work.
So having good legal, great operating agreement.
Don't skip on legal at all. Yeah.
Skip on legal. And the other thing too is I think a lot of you who've seen the Facebook movie, too many of you have seen the Facebook movie.
Because everybody thinks like that's how everything in the world works.
So then they come to us all the time about, you know, I have equity, and I'm going to get money, yeah. I'm going to sue, and I'm going to do this. Timberlake's in there and all that stuff. So, yeah, just going through team dynamics for yeah. the only issues. The guy that got out, still talk to him?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just wondering how it happened when you exited.
Yeah, I mean,
because there's that happens.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, it was, you know, I think, you know, ultimately, I mean, I can't speak for him, but you know, my
way that I sort of think that it went down was, and I think we both were
inexperienced. It was certainly probably a lot of it was on me, and I think our expectations for what we wanted at the company was probably a little bit different. And you know, for him, I needed to bring people on before I got there. It was part of like the requirement for TechStars was to have developers who are going to be there. So hired him like literally a week before, and you know, he wasn't a long-term fit. And it's something you learn again, as I've done this a few times, is, you know, you make a lot of mistakes, but you ideally don't make the same ones twice. And the mistake wasn't hiring a person. It was like maybe the way that I interacted with them, or the way that I treated them, or the way that we worked together, right, or communicated. So
TechStars does ask for a CTO or a dev.
Yeah, usually.
Development? You're the brains behind the idea. Do you know any development, or did you get into any of that?
I didn't. So that was why I hired someone so quickly, right? And like, in hindsight, or I had the opportunity that, you know, a lot of you guys have here, you know, make sure you like network and meet people that have like, you know, diverse, you know, skill sets, right? And make sure that you can match or build a team that like makes sense, right? Like you don't want four salespeople and right. No one to make anything, right? Then you'll just sell a bunch of stuff and never get done. So those are the things that I, again, like so dumb of me to start without that, but it was something that you learn from, you know. I mean, I wouldn't do it again, but there was no going back once right. I started, so.
So you start growing, you start hiring people, you get up to 45 employees. When does that happen? I mean, how far down the road?
So we got, I'll sort of walk you through. Yeah. So 2011 was TechStars. At the time when sort of we split up, it was me by myself. So I got a tiny office. We had enough revenue that I could get a tiny office.
And where was that?
In Birmingham, Michigan. Yeah. It had single pane windows. There was like literally weeds growing out of the concrete floor. It was,
but it was an office,
right? We raised a couple $100,000, which sounds like a lot, but actually today that's like a few pennies now where people are raising. It's crazy.
You raised that?
Yes.
How difficult was that?
It was difficult. We started fundraising in October, 2011, which was TechStars. Mm-hmm. And some of the people committed that day. And we didn't actually get the money until like mid 2012.
Wow.
And that was for a company that went through TechStars and that was also doing like 100,000 in revenue. So it was like, we had a lot of pretty good traction.
Yeah.
And it was still really challenging. And then from there we basically took that money and we got all the way to $1 million a year in revenue. And that was 2015.
In the same office?
No, we had upgraded one office. We upgraded to one office.
All right.
And then we went to Royal Oak and we hit a million in revenue, and then we raised about $2.5 million. And that's when we got to 45 people. Then we went from 12 people to 45.
Going back, and again, as I brought up in the beginning, everybody thinks they need to raise all this money. Would you do it the same way? Because every time you're raising money, you're giving away a slice of the
pie. For sure. For sure. Yeah. I would do it the same way, but I would actually raise the $2.5 million earlier.
Could you without the traction? That's chicken.
It would have been tough. Yep. It would have been tough. I mean, that was the first time in my opinion, where we could actually hire people ahead of the revenue.
Yep.
So, you know, we would make $10,000 a month or another $10,000, and then we'd hire one more person. And then a couple of months later, we'd hire another person. And so you're always sort of chasing the next person and hoping that the money keeps coming in. And when we raised that sort of institutional round with the VC, then we were able to hire four people at a time, six people at a time. mind you, we totally screwed that up too. So, you know, like that's a whole nother animal in terms of how you hire and bring people on and how you, you know, manage your culture.
Talk about that a little bit, because I know some individuals that have hired a lot of people and didn't realize as a young person, I'm going to raise all this money and then I'm going to have 100 employees.
Yeah.
It sounds like to me it's one of the most difficult parts, the hiring and firing and friends and talk about that.
Yeah, there really are, I think, two like fundamental parts of like entrepreneurship. There's one is like building a product or creating a service. And then the second one is actually building a company around that product or service. The first part you can do really easily by yourself. You can build a product with a friend, you can be a consultant, and you can make really good money. And that might be that might allow you to hit all this, you know, any goals that you have in life. Building the company is a whole nother animal. And it's actually a lot different than the building of the cool thing that you started. Yeah. You know, it's about people, it's about, you know, culture and all these things that I had no experience with. I was coming out of law school, never had a real job. And all of a sudden I'm managing people and giving them and firing people, right? And hiring people and managing benefits and people with, I don't have kids, people with kids, people with all these things that you don't think about. But if you're the founder, that's your job. You can't just pretend it's not.
And what about having a company here in Michigan? At that time, was it hard to find developers? They want wages. They want West Coast wages. I mean, was that tough?
We
found the ones that wanted to be here.
I think we got really lucky. It was as the idea of startups became more popular, more and more people were interested in joining startups. So it became easier as time went on, as people realized, or maybe if they didn't feel sort of the social pressure that it was like bad to join a startup. Like in the Valley, it's cool. But like in Michigan, my parents were like, when are you going to get a real job? Right. Like it was very different. And that was like sort of the overwhelming thought of most of the people's parents or peers was they kind of have a fake job. Like they don't even maybe get benefits.
You think that's a Midwest thing, you know, because I do think, you know, our program is about 7 years old, and about 7 years ago, I was honestly getting calls from parents.
Yeah.
Saying, what are you doing to my son or daughter? And we are very Rust Belt.
Yeah.
Get your job and stick with it, hopefully for quite a while. Do you think that's a Midwestern thing? Or
I think it was just a lack of knowledge, you know, truly. As I think people see the successes, as they see the other startup companies growing in their town or in Detroit or in Grand Rapids or in Lansing, right? Then you understand that there's nothing wrong with it. And for us, like one of the things that I used to say was there should be nothing wrong with liking where you work.
Sure.
Like, why is it a thing where you hate your job? Like that sucks. And so like, to me, it's like, why don't we create a culture where people like want to be here and they want to work together? Like that shouldn't be crazy. And so I think as people saw that, and I know for us, like we were, you know, we had a relatively young organization in Royal Oak where a lot of kids in Metro Detroit, you know, wanted to move to, and like people were like, oh, they were like jealous. And it was like we were fortunate. We had dozens of applicants every day. So there was only so much engineering talent. So that was always particularly hard, but we got so many resumes every day. I mean, we could have hired 1,000 people. We couldn't pay them, but we could, you know, we had a lot of people interested. But that took a lot of time to get to that point. And it was also building a reputation of ideally doing things well or doing things better than other companies around. So the bar was pretty low.
How was the culture of the office? Because starting a startup like that, sometimes you have to be conducive to the people that are there. Was it Google-esque? Were you adding gaming stuff? Was it a fun atmosphere? I mean, different than the corporate side, or how was it?
It was definitely open environment. It was every office got a little bit more like cool, I guess. And the first one was like, I mean, it was tiny. There was always a ping pong table, which is super cliche, but we had some good ping pong battles. And actually Scott, one of the good ping pong players is here. So he always beat me, which was annoying. But you know, we had like bean bags and, you know, cool conference rooms that were not as good as these, but like were pretty cool, you know. And so I think over time it was an open concept. It was collaborative. It was fun. You know, we did team lunches every Friday, then Wednesday. So it's like everyone ate together and kind of socialized. So we tried to make it, you know, somewhat collaborative. There were no offices. I didn't have an office. I was in front of everybody like everybody else. I tried to lead, you know, by example and kind of be out in front.
We've given tours to entrepreneurship associations, to the WE Group and others, and we visited, you know, West Coast and others. And
yeah,
some of these startups are ridiculous.
Yeah.
That you go in there and there's so much food.
Yeah.
So much. I was like, do you guys ever go home? There's dog grooming and laundry. I mean, did you have to get to that point to really recruit some of these people, or?
So we didn't. And that's the benefit of being in Michigan is that there's a lot less competition from a startup perspective, right? From a, let's say, a cool company or growing company perspective. I mean, we're competing against maybe Ford, right? Or some place that maybe isn't seen as cool. In the Valley, they're all competing against each other. So the one that has like the better chef or like the dog grooming, right? Or the babysitting, like that's like a huge perk that, I mean, it's a whole different animal out West. And as you know, so, I mean, it is insane. It's crazy. I've seen plenty of those, and that's why they raise crazy amounts of money and do all these other things. And that's also why, you know, they'll raise a ton of money, but then they'll have 1,000 people laid off.
Yeah.
Right. So it's, if you know what you're getting into and you know, that's the game you're playing, I mean, maybe that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
One of the things that I, you know, always said and told the team is, hey, we might not have like the craziest, like, growth at all costs, or we're not going to raise the most money, but we're not going to have like mass layoffs either.
Yeah.
And so that's the trade-off that I'm making, and like hopefully, and like we're all on the same page as like accepting that we're not going to try to, you know, triple the business every year, but if we miss, we don't have to fire the last 20 people we hired. And so that was just a personal decision, but we communicated that and told people that in the interview process, so they kind of knew that.
So when did you know that you're getting to the point of maybe the first person knocking your door about acquiring you?
It was something that was, so at our stage we had investors and we had a board. So at every quarter there's a board meeting, and generally once every couple meetings, the sort of idea of, you know, you're always thinking about, again, what does the world look like a year out or 6 months out? So, you know, one of the things that I was always doing along with sort of some of the cultural things is thinking about like what are our options, either to raise money as like a catalyst, right? Or to find some other option to sell or what have you. So selling had sort of been on the table for maybe 6 months before we sort of started the process. And it was a combination of like conversations that I had with the board, with other investors, and then also with some of the team. You know, I mean, I think, you know, the pace at which people push in a startup, it's intense, and it's not for everybody. And you can only push people so hard before they burn out, or, you know, they rebel, right? I mean, not truly rebel, but like get to the point where they're like, I can't do this anymore. And so I think for me, it felt like we were kind of at that kind of critical juncture where we were going to have to make some big changes to sort of get to the next level or see what other options were. And for me personally, I was probably at the point of burnout as well. I was doing it for almost 10 years. I got very little sleep. I was, you know, always tired, and I think mentally just like drained and just, you know, making decisions all day, every day. And so it felt like it was a good time, I think, for a lot of people. And so that was kind of when we started pursuing it. And it probably took about a year. The whole process was about a year.
And you and I briefly talked about this. You have these 45 employees who are basically your family.
Yeah.
In there. And you're talking about selling. When somebody sells a company, sometimes that changes. If it's private equity, if it's others, that changes that company. Was that a concern of them coming in and just laying off or totally ruining? I mean, was that a big concern?
Huge concern. So throughout the process, there were a handful of people from Ambassador that were sort of in the tent, and that means they were part of the discussions. And yeah, it was a leadership team and a couple other folks that were sort of involved. And the biggest sticking point for us was laying off people was like not an acceptable outcome. And that was like literally written in the legal agreement. So it was like, couldn't really happen. There was lots of retention bonuses and other things that they keep people. And so part of the process is to navigate that. I mean, it's like, you know,
so going back to the good legal.
For sure. I mean, the cost of the lawyers was so ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy, but it's, you know, if you imagine like the most crazy contract you've ever done, you know, maybe it's buying a house and you're just flipping through like all these pages are just like sign it or, you know, some contract, whatever. I mean, it was like infinitely crazier than that, right? It was just, you know, 1,000 pages of legalese and, you know, 20 lawyers looking at it at a time. And it's a pretty crazy process. It's hard to explain unless you go through it. But to answer the question, I guess culture was the primary concern, and trying to figure out a way to make sure that we can maintain the standards that we set. And listen, to be honest, like some things went better than I thought and some things went worse. And it was like, shit, I really screwed that up. And like, there's no going back. Yeah. Like 2 days after we were done, I like told my wife, I'm like, this was a mistake. And like some of the things got corrected, sure, but it was like a couple of loopholes are like, oh, we're actually going to do this way. And we're like, whoa, that's not what we thought. And you can't, they're like, hey, we're a $1 billion company. We don't care what you think anymore, Jeff. Yeah. Like you're not important.
You signed this.
Yeah. And so that was a wake up call.
So you sell, and I'm sure there was diligence going through this, and you still had to be in the office for a little bit. When was that first day, if you remember or not, or first week? And what did you do? Like
after we sold?
Yeah.
Honestly, I didn't do anything. I don't think I did anything different. I was like super relieved. I think I probably slept like
you
full
retired.
Night. Yeah. I don't know. When you see movies, like people like celebrate with like crazy champagne and stuff or whatever. It's
no,
like,
not what I was in for. I'm like, did you relax? I mean, you finally just took some time.
So I didn't relax until I was totally done. Yeah. And the reason was, it was like as soon, it was actually way more stressful after the sale because then I had literally no control.
Yeah.
So like when problems came up, it was like, oh my God, like, why can't I fix this? Like, you know, little things at first, like they didn't want to use Gmail or something. And we're like, wait, everyone loves Gmail. Why are you not using Gmail?
Yeah.
And it was like, that's like a major problem. Like people are like, oh, you love Gmail and my shortcuts and everything. So
but
it was like,
anymore,
right.
Man.
And so, you know, that was incredibly stressful and I didn't expect it. And it was hard. I think it was hard for everybody, you know? And I would say like I think everyone worked well collaborating. You know, I was willing to be sort of the bad guy. And so I sort of was like, hey, you guys, like I'm probably not going to be here. We sort of knew I probably wasn't going to be there super long. Yeah. So like, let me be the bad guy and say, hey guys, we got to fix this. You know, don't ruin your future potential. You know, I'll take the fall. So, you know, I did that a couple times and I probably made some enemies inside of that company, but it was worth it. You know, I think for me, it was like fighting for something you believe in. And so that was until I was totally done, which was like December 31st. I was pretty stressed. I didn't have a lot of work to do. I just had a lot of like fielding a lot of complaints and like helping try to fix stuff.
Well, I do want to get into some questions here, but one real quick thing too. What are you doing now?
So my plan, as soon as my last day was like December 31st, 2018. So 2019, I was like, I'm going to take as much time, take a year and kind of decompress. And I'm still kind of in that process, which has been,
good.
I thought I would hate it, but it actually was pretty nice. And so, I mean, I've been doing stuff. I've been doing a little bit of consulting. I've been doing, I've been helping friends, businesses, and I've been mentoring some folks and, made a couple small investments. So I've been pretty active, but on a much easier on my end, sort of mentally for me, and a lot less decision making and more just like kind of helping people versus like kind of burning the candle on both ends, so to speak. So it's been a nice reprieve, but I'm starting to get the itch.
Ideas.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, good. Okay, questions? Want to get it up with questions? We have microphones.
Ah, it works. Of course. Yep. Okay. We'll get you. Get my steps in.
Hi there.
Hey.
So you mentioned wanting to get that like $2 million investment or whatnot much sooner if you could. How would you recommend for like a smaller business that doesn't have that repute to make themselves more attractive to investors?
Yeah. So sooner would maybe mean like a 6 months, not like material right. amount sooner in my case. The best way to get investment is really to not need it. So the way that we got it was people were reaching out to us saying, we want to give you money. And like, I literally was just like, no, thanks. We're not interested. And that got people actually more excited. The reason why people are reaching out to us at that point is because people knew who we were, because our customers were, you know, either T-Mobile or Hulu or these big sort of big brands. People knew who we were. So, you know, like I said, most of the time the business sort of speaks for itself. Things that you can do to sort of enhance or make it more likely you'll get money given the business is going well is obviously start getting a hold of and meeting with and networking with investors before you need it. Right. The cliche is ask for advice, not for money. And that always makes sense. Once you ask for money and someone says no, it's really hard to get money from them. You typically would say, what do you think we need? Where do we need to be to raise X money? The investors aren't stupid. They know that you're considering raising money. And if they like it, they'll be like, you know what? You should just take our money. Those things happen all the time. But you want to make sure that you're not just plastering out, hey, we're desperate for money. We're desperate for money. Like, no one wants to give people money that are desperate. So you sort of have to, you know, play it cool and say, you know, where does my business need to be for someone like you to be interested?
Let me add to that real quick, because I know a lot of you have asked me, do you see a magic number of users or a magic number in sales when people start looking at you?
Yeah. Well, it's gone down a little bit, but for us, like a million in recurring revenue is sort of like one of the magic numbers. But I think, and you can sort of think about it typically in like almost like 10x increments. So 100,000 in recurring revenue is probably, you could raise, you know, a seed round, right? Very rarely will you be able to raise based on an idea. It almost like you, it happens, but it's very rare. You typically need to show traction, right? And traction would be the other thing aside from asking for advice is if you have a network of VCs or you have what you should create is maybe like an email distribution list to say, you know, hey, all my VCs that are interested and mentors and friends and blah, blah, blah. Here are the stats of our business. And every month you should update them, hopefully with much better stats than the month before, right? And like show that traction. And then that will get people to invest. So that was one of the great things that we learned at TechStars. They taught us how to do that. And it's almost like gaming the system. You get people really fired up about it. No one actually knows how many people are on the list, but you say, thank every, you know, you sell it. Thanks so much, everybody, for, you know, all your feedback this month. You know, we said we were going to grow by 20%, but we actually grew by 30. Like, things are going great. You know, talk to you next month. And you build that momentum, right? Like, you're always selling, you know, you're selling, you're not, you have to be truthful, of course, or it's best to be truthful, but you're selling your business. You're selling that it's a good investment. Like, it's not charity. It's literally an investment. They expect to make a lot of money off of you. In reality.
Other questions?
Oh, yeah, right there.
go for it.
So my question was, is it a mistake to hire friends even if they aren't qualified for the jobs?
That is a great question. So, man.
Can you repeat the question for the video?
Yeah, the question was, is it a mistake to hire friends even if they're qualified for the job? Working with friends is really tough. I don't think I successfully hired someone who was a friend. And multiple times it created problems of even friends applying and me not knowing how to handle it. So I personally was pretty bad at it. I know people that have done it. For me, I think the challenge is I think early on, it's almost like a marriage, right? Like you maybe early on you want to be a friend, but once there's like a hiring dynamic of like, oh, we're friends, but like you have to, I'm your boss now. I think that makes it a lot more challenging. So co-founders, I think, is a pretty normal and probably a positive thing. But I think if you are, you know, managing your friend, it's tough. I mean, I think it could work, but I didn't want to go down that road. And again, for me, there's all these other optical issues, right? Like if your friend is like treating you with less respect or teases you, but like your company doesn't tease you, like you can't sort of allow that, like, you know, friends to be like, I tried to be friendly, but I was sort of careful not to be like buddy buddy with people. That was just my own personal choice because I just didn't think it was like totally professional. And like, I think everyone sort of learns the best way to do things. I've become close with a lot of people, but become closer after I've actually left. And after they've left most of the time. It's a good question though.
Awesome. Yeah, Jeff, I like what you said about don't ask for money, ask for advice. This one's kind of for the live listeners. So I have some advice about where to find money. We gave you a sheet, Privco. I highly recommend checking out Privco if you're looking for private equity, venture capital, seed funding, A, B, C, D, that sort of thing. My question though is, we talked a lot about a company that you have sold. I'm curious about, I guess you're with the Forbes Technology Council and you said you do a bit of consulting. Can you talk a little bit about the consulting that you do? Because it's a pretty general term.
Yeah. And I've primarily just been trying to help mentor people. The consulting that I've done in the last year has been really helping with the hiring and the culture side of things. A couple of my friends and old investors have asked me to like talk to some of their portfolio companies when they're just raising money and sort of going through the growing pains that we went through in terms of going from 6 people to 20 to 30. And like, how do you hire sort of your first adult, you know, I mean, It's weird. You know, I hired someone who was much, much older than me and was honestly much more polished than me in every way. And, you know, I learned a lot from him, but it probably wasn't the best experience for him, you know, like babysitting me maybe. So like those are things that I think you don't think about, when you're in the process of just raising money, but those are real life issues that you have to navigate. And so I did a lot of sort of CEO coaching, things like that. Very sort of high level, you know, my plan was, I don't want to get into the weeds and do a lot of deliverables. It was more like, I'm gonna be strategic and just help people and sort of mentor them and help them avoid the mistakes that I made with kind of growing a team.
Other questions? We got time for a little bit more. We got Brian over there. Brian, you just want to talk loud over there?
Yeah. Can you talk about your first customer and being in the referral business?
Yes, my first customer, I still remember her name. I won't say it, but it was, she sold like an info product, but it was literally from like 2012. And I probably spent like 20 hours helping her and she paid us like $50 a month, just not good unit economics there. the story of our customers is pretty embarrassing, but basically we had a freemium, which means anyone could sign up. And for a long period of time, maybe 6 months, like no one actually ended up paying us. So we ended up changing that business model to something that made sense so we could make some money. But that was one of the things, again, you learn as you go.
But it built user base.
Yeah, built a little bit of user base. It got things going and got sort of built a feedback loop, see what people didn't like and figure that out. Best practices for referrals. Honestly, the best way to get more referrals is to have an awesome product and have an awesome experience. It's, again, super cliche. We used to always tell people, like, our product itself won't get you more referrals. We help you, like, track and manage that process. So you optimize it with Ambassador. Just because you buy Ambassador doesn't make people talk about how amazing you are. Like, if you're American Airlines, like, people aren't saying you're amazing because you buy Ambassador. Like, they don't want to get delayed and they don't want to get bumped off their flight. Right. So
customer service part of it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, ultimately, yeah, exactly. Like, create an experience that people want to talk about you. And that goes for anything, right? Like the best businesses, the whatever it is that you love, right? It's because you had an amazing experience with them. And, you know, software isn't going to fix that. It's just going to be able to optimize it if good things are happening. And so that's what we were, was sort of a system to help manage and accelerate that function of people talking about you. It wasn't just going to make it happen out of nowhere, right?
You mentioned you did your undergrad at Eli Broad. What did you get your degree in? And did you find your undergrad experience more valuable or less valuable than your experience in law school or your career?
Wow. So have you heard the question? It was, what did my degree was general business pre-law. Was it more valuable? I mean, generally speaking, business, I think for me was more valuable and it wasn't necessarily like as important as like some of the concepts are. The thing that you learn in business school that I learned that I didn't really learn anywhere else was actually working with other people. And that, it's super cliche and probably sounds really lame, but like no matter what you do, you need to work with people and work well with people, right? Like to me, the experience of college, the relationships you build and the way that you interact with folks that maybe are very different from your high school experience, like that's like one of the most valuable things that I got. Like there were, I'm not at West Bloomfield anymore, right? There's all these other, you know, different types of people with different interests and different experiences. And that was like mind blown kind of for like someone who felt like relatively sheltered existence. Right. And so like that was more valuable because that happened before I got to law school. Like the legal stuff, like that was really important. Like how to navigate contracts that I obviously learned in law school, but I mean, I think business school was hugely valuable. But again, it was, you know, in a lot of ways it's what you make of it. You know, like I wish I could access some of these things and find people that I could potentially start a business with, right? Like that I could find developers or find people that like love startups. Like, again, that didn't even exist, which is just crazy. So that to me is the value, like build networks of people that like 10 years down the road, if you have an idea that you could call, you know, like that's amazing that you might know people that you have, a, you know, 10 or 20 people that you could do that with, or that you may want to work with someday. Those are relationships that are really hard to forge at the last minute, like I did, and I screwed it up, you know, and that was a pretty expensive mistake.
What was like for you personally, what was the thing that you got out of the most, like from like the experience of starting your business and selling it? Like, how did you get out of that?
That's a good question. So the question was, what did I get the most out of the whole experience of starting a business? I think the best personal gain for me was confidence, actually. Believe it or not, like when I, like one of the reasons why I don't ever think I got a real job, I was like terrified to even interview. Like I was like super nervous. Like I was scared to speak, obviously, like call someone on the phone. I was scared. You know, you learn some of that in different classes, right? And you have to speak up and those skills are like super valuable, but looking back and seeing the things that I did, like I definitely didn't get a lot right the first time, but I didn't stop trying. And eventually I'm like, you know what? I can actually do that again. If I had to do it, I could do it. And, you know, coming out of school, I didn't know that I was capable of those things. And I didn't even apply to jobs because I was like, oh, I'm not good enough for that job, you know? And in some ways that pushed me to do something on my own. It's like, I can't fire myself for a while, you know, at least, you know? So, you know, in those ways, I think that was really helpful for me. I mean, it pushed me and at a certain point I'm like, you know, I have to do something because everyone's kind of expecting, there's low expectations. Like, you know, aside from my wife and maybe a couple other people, like, I would say most people had no idea for the last 10 years,
these ramen noodles, I can't eat.
Right. And everyone just was like, yeah, what's that kid doing? Yeah. You know, like he posts some stupid stuff on Facebook or whatever. Like, what does this company do? And then, you know,
we got time for one more.
Yeah. One more, Paul.
Okay. So everyone likes money. How do you get people to commit and work when you can't afford to have a payroll yet?
Yeah. So that is,
what was the question, Jeff?
Oh, sorry. The question was, how do you get people to work with you if you can't afford to pay them? And again, this is like the ultimate struggle and something that I dealt with a lot. And I think you have to pay them something, right? Like, I mean, you can maybe get some free work from people, but ultimately what I did was I gave people part of the company. And I did that. We did that the entire time. Like when we hired people, we would say, we are not, you can make more money in other places. Or sometimes people would come to Ambassador and make less. But we said, what you do get is this amazing place to learn and grow and hopefully the best job you ever had or the best place you ever worked, smartest place you ever worked. But you're also going to get equity and upside. And for some people that was, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, a lot of money.
Most demand now.
Right.
Especially on the developer
right.
side.
Right. So I think it's a trade-off, you know, I mean, I think it's definitely hard and convincing people, you know, the best thing to convince people besides offering them equity is to convince them that it's a mission that makes sense for them, right? That a mission that is aligns with their personal values and that your values align with them as well. So if you can get someone to believe in that, then you can maybe get them for something then less than they could earn from another company that they don't care about as much, you know?
Good question. If you could all join me in thanking Jeff for being here tonight. Thanks, I appreciate it. And thank you, Paul, for moderating this evening. Jeff, we've just got like a little care package for you here from MSU. We talked earlier about Land Grant Goods and Bright Bites, yep. Some of our student-run startups or student-founded ventures here at MSU. We actually have some of their products in here
nice.
For you to take home for you and your wife. So Paul's going to give that to you.
Thank you,
and we just thank you so much for being here this evening, flying from New York City and sharing all of your knowledge with our group. So thanks again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Oh, Chris, can I say one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
So one last thing. I know if you guys have questions and you want to ping me, you can find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. It's at Jeff_Epstein. So just hit me up on there and say, hey, I saw you at MSU and, you know, feel free to you know, ask any questions.
Absolutely. And I think it's my understanding you're going to be able to stick around for a few minutes here this evening.
Yeah.
So if you've got an individual question you want to bring up to Jeff, he's going to hang out for a little bit here. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks.
Hatchcast was created by me, Aaron Richard, and is produced by the Bridges Institute for Entrepreneurship in cooperation with the MSU Foundation. Gabe Hales is our editor and sound designer. Our co-producers and writers include Gabe Hales, Brandon Weaver, and myself. Original music and sound is created by Katya Gaudina with help from Aubrey Haas, Brandon Weaver, Caitlin Sutter, Sydney Owinga, Kurt Krieger, Tyler Mihai, Gabriella Ellum, Jeff Smith, Paul Jakes, Ken Smuziak, Desiree Melfi, Neil Kane, and Laurie Fisher. Thank you.